Well, hey everybody, and welcome back to X-Files Diaries. I'm Annie.
I'm Jen.
And today we're going to continue in our mythology discussion. We're going to wrap up season one and start out season two with one of Jen's favorite episodes, if I recall correctly,
yes.
Little Green Men.
Boom.
But before we get into that, Jen, you have some tweets of the week.
He's made outrageous public statements on an internet site.
That wasn't him. That was me. And they're not outrageous.
Okay. Tweets of the week. These are in response to our interview last week with Avi Quijada. Thank you, Avi, for joining us. And we had a lot of great responses to that. And it was just such a delight to talk to her and to learn so much. And our first tweet is from Casey at Bath. Hello, Casey. Great interview. Fascinating life you have, Avi. I was one that was always looking to XFN for the latest news in pre-Twitter days. Thank you for all your work and hope your family is doing okay in Venezuela. Ah, nice. From Lenka. Lenka says, great discussion. Isn't it amazing how the fandom evolved from mailing lists to podcasts? Sure is. But most importantly, it never ceased to exist and there have always been and are fans who carry on with it. X-Files news was such an important part of it all. Thanks, Avi and company. Absolutely, Lenka. That's so true. The fandom just keeps on going. And yeah, X-Files News was a really key part of it there. Karen says, what a fantastic interview. Avi, you are an inspiration. And she is. Thank you, Karen. From Monica. Monica says, I have to say I stan women who support Scully as a mother, who recognize her valid hope to pursue that normalcy and all the amazing things her strong female character represents. It's nice to hear you, Avi, speak about your enjoyment of seasons 8 and 9. Her mother love is amazing to see. That's a great point, isn't it, Annie, about Scully and her role as a mom?
Yeah, I really like hearing that because, you know, I just feel like I hear a lot of other things, a lot of negative things about that, and I don't hear a lot of positivity about Scully's role as a mom. As a mom myself, it's nice to hear that. So thank you, Monica.
Yeah, awesome. There's a lot of moms in the fandom, especially, you know, folks that were watching it back in the day. Some of us are old enough to be grandmoms now. So shout out to the X-File grandmoms and granddads who might be listening right now. I had you big time, says, hi, Jen. Hi, I had you big time. During your podcast, you apologized to me. As I said, I now watch The X-Files out of episodic order as per our chats. You've nothing to apologize for. In fact, you've done me a favor because the thought of watching 11 seasons was too much for me. I can kind of see that. I had you big time. That would be rather daunting. I mean, of course, when we were watching it back in the day, it was just week to week. There wasn't like this immense sort of monolith of episodes stretching out before us. So I can see that that would be a daunting task. So I am all for random order rewatches. So you go. You do you. Watch it in whatever order you want. Don't feel like you have to go in order because that would be a long stretch. And it would, I think after a while, it might just kind of feel like a little bit like a task that you've set for yourself instead of just something fun to do.
Right.
That's why I enjoy the random rewatching because it's just something fun to do. And I don't have to like eat my vegetables to get to my dessert kind of thing. I never have to watch an episode that I'm not like really excited to watch. So I'm all for it.
I think most people probably watch it that way. And I generally will, if I want to like watch a certain episode, I will pop it in and definitely watch it. But I like to watch them in order because I feel like if I don't, then I will miss things. And I will always tend to go back to the same ones like over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Which there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, that's awesome. But like, I feel like there are a lot of details that maybe you miss if you don't watch certain episodes that if you skip them, you know? So yeah. I don't know. My personal preference is to try to go in order, but obviously we can't always do that. Sometimes you're just in the mood for a certain one. So what are you gonna do?
Absolutely. You can also kind of combine them a little bit and sort of generally do it in order. And then just like when you're jonesing for a particular episode, kind of skip to that one.
Leap around.
And then go back to sort of your rewatch.
And then go back. That's kind of what I do. Like I'm always kind of in the middle of a rewatch. Right. And so
it's an ongoing thing.
Yeah. And it lasts, you know, a long time. And so I'll kind of remember, okay, that's where I left off. But I really want to watch this like season 7 episode right now. So I'm going to go to that, and then I'll go back. And sometimes watching them around in weird, different, unusual orders makes you sort of notice new things. So
yeah, that's true as well.
Yeah.
One advantage for sure about doing it, just watching it in order, is you don't spend any time trying to decide what episode to watch that day.
Right.
So you're like, I know which episode to watch. It's the next one in order. The only time I've watched any portion of the X-Files in order after the original airing was recently, like a year or so ago, I watched season 8 all in one go. And it was so easy. It was like every day I knew which episode I was going to watch. I waste an inordinate amount of time trying to decide what episode I might feel like watching on that particular day. So I can see that that's one of the advantages of just an in-order rewatch, is that you're not wasting time to decide which one to watch.
Have you ever watched the entire thing as a rewatch in order?
No.
Never.
Except, not as a rewatch, just when it originally aired.
Well, I mean,
never again.
That's crazy.
To quote one of the episodes. Yeah. I'm just like a kid in the candy store after sort of having to wait 9 years to get through all of the episodes the first time around. It was many years before I actually had access to all of the episodes at one time again, because, you know, we couldn't afford to buy all of the episodes. I had like a couple of my favorite seasons on videotape, and just the recordings I had made of the seasons, which weren't as complete as I wanted. Some of them had gone awry. So when we were able to finally get convenient access to all of the episodes at one time, which was when Netflix started to stream them, it was like, I was so excited. Just to be, the fact that I could watch any episode I wanted, any time I wanted, I've never gotten over it.
On demand.
On demand. I'm to this day, I can't get over that excitement.
Yeah.
And as I frequently complain, when Netflix Canada took the X-Files off, I didn't for a moment even consider anything other than just having digital access, because I'm so used to that now. So I just downloaded the whole darn thing from iTunes, and so happy to own all of the episodes now. I'm never going to be dependent on a streaming service ever again.
Yeah, I have to go over to iTunes and buy them, because they're on sale right now for like $30, right?
I don't know, are they? Paid $100 the whole
shebang. I think
shebang.
The entire series is on sale right now on iTunes for like $30, and I'm like, I don't care. I'll have it on another platform. I'm gonna do it.
Run, don't walk at that price. I mean, I thought I was going to deal for $100 to get like 218 episodes. So I was perfectly happy with that. But $30, I mean, everyone should just have that now.
Yeah.
Because
everyone,
you know, you might want to watch it while you're like somewhere that has Wi-Fi and you just have your phone with you. Hey, maybe I'll just watch this X-Files episode while I'm waiting in my doctor's office. Why not?
Why not?
You could. That's the wonder of it all. And if you're like, what does happen? What's that one thing that Mulder says in that episode? I can't remember. You can find out right away, because it's all available to you. So there you go. I feel like iTunes should be doing something for us for the fact that we just plugged it so thoroughly. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I guess, you know, iTunes is very kind that they distribute our podcast. And that's great, I guess. But, you know, iTunes, you could do a little something for us. Maybe just bump us up a little bit, maybe on the searches or something like that, for the fact that we just really gave you a lot of great free advertising. But, you know, I love iTunes. I appreciate all that they do to support podcasts. And I love our listeners. Thank you, everybody, for your tweets, as always. Tweet us anytime at XFDpodcast. And we would love to hear from you, as would other fans. So thanks.
Mulder, the internet is not good for you.
All right. So, Jen, we have reached the end of season 1 in our mythology journey. What do you think so far? Where are you at in terms of like what you comprehend? Like, are you still at a pretty good level?
I'm good. I'm feeling pretty good. Season 1 is probably my favorite mythology season overall, because I'm still feeling like I'm really on top of things during season 1. There's not too much. No alien bounty hunters have shown up yet or anything. So I'm still feeling really good about it. And I love this season 1 mythology, because it's all my favorite sort of back to basic stuff. It's UFOs and paranoia and conspiracies. And that's my favorite thing about The X-Files. So I love all of the mythology episodes in season one. I don't know if I can say that for every season, but for season one, I thought that they were all really strong and I love them. And I started to feel just a little shaky when we got to Erlenmeyer Flask with the introduction of human alien hybrid situation. But I feel like I understand as much as I am meant to at this point. Mm-hmm. And I feel pretty good about it. I'm feeling like I'm ready for more. Like, let's add on the next layer, because I know that's where it's going to be from here on out. It's all about the layering when it comes to the mythology. And I feel like my foundation is strong.
It's interesting because a lot of the things that they talk about in season one, like, they do come back in sort of in their own little ways, like here and there. But I think from this point on, everything, like you said, is layering, and it's just like planting little seeds and little, yep, like, to, so that when later, when like things get far more complicated, we have, like you said, this groundwork to base off. In terms of like where the mythology is going to go, I mean, we all know, and no show ever really knows how things are going to change and evolve and move on. They kind of abandoned some of the ideas here, like these classic sort of, I would say, tropey alien abduction scenarios. We don't really stick with that sort of stuff.
Less about abductions as we go on.
Yeah, I mean, we do obviously have, you know, the huge Scully abduction, but like we will, like we will talk about, that's a different kind of abduction, I believe, than what happens later down the road to Mulder, which is, again, seven seasons later. So we do get around to this stuff again, but I think they're just sort of priming us. Like, I feel like this is a really good primer season. Like, hey, you're going to be watching some weird stuff, guys. Mm-hmm. Get ready, because next season we're gonna get wacky, and we're going to involve our main characters, which again was not we'll talk about this when the Duane Barry arc comes up. It was not planned, but it did end up informing like the rest of the mythology, especially as regards to Scully, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. And this is like a good sort of primer season. You know, there's nothing too complicated, so it was an easy bus to jump onto, because it was all sort of the kind of thing that were kind of in the vernacular in the 90s about UFOs and abductions and conspiracies and the like. So it was the kind of thing that wasn't too hard to grab onto at that point. So it's kind of a gentle introduction before things get crazy. And so I like it. I like it a lot for that reason.
And I do understand, too, that like when things start to get crazy, it almost seems like they ran out of things to do. But there's only so far they can take the classic alien abduction scenario and the classic government cover up. There's only so far they could take that. And so they had to sort of come up with a way to move it forward. And I know, like, coming into the next few seasons, like, we're going to get a lot of, why did they go this way? Why did they go that? That doesn't make any sense. There's too much going on. And it'll just be interesting to see how that all unfolds. Did you have anything else to say to wrap up season one before we get on to Little Green Men?
I don't think so. I think it's a great season, and I really like where it takes us from there. And I think in general, I get the sense that season one as a full season is sometimes an underrated season. I feel like maybe people don't rewatch the episodes as much as some of the later seasons, but it is a really strong season. So if you don't include it super often in your rewatch, you should definitely watch all of season one, because it's actually a really great season, really stands up surprisingly and incredibly well. So there's some really, really strong episodes in season one. So it's my little boost for season one.
And you know what's a little rare is I think season one is one of the rare seasons where the mythology episodes are actually stronger than the Monster of the Week episodes.
Yeah, I think you're probably right.
For the most part.
Yeah, there's a couple of classic Monster of the Week episodes, of course, because we have like Ice and Squeeze and Tombs and things like that. But there's a couple of weak ones, my opinion.
There's a few weak ones. I just think that it's rare that we get every single, like we were even saying as we were talking through the mythology that all of these mythology episodes are very strong.
Yeah, they're all great in my books. Yeah. There's nothing weak about any of them, which is, I don't think there's a single season after that necessarily that I could say that about.
Yeah.
Maybe season two, we'll see, I guess. We'll see in season two whether it holds up.
Yeah. Well, speaking of season two, that brings us into the season two premiere, Little Green Men. Mm-hmm. And Jen, I have to eat a little bit of crow, I think, because I remember when we were talking about our favorite episodes and this came up on your list, and I was just kind of like, eh.
You kind of were.
Yeah. And I don't really rewatch this one very often for whatever reason. I don't know. It's just not one that comes up. This is a really good episode.
Yes.
It's fantastic. And I just remember watching it thinking, I don't know why I had in my mind that I thought this episode was kind of slow and boring. And I'm like, it's not. It's got all kinds of stuff. It's got so many things. It's firing on all cylinders. It's really good. A really strong start to the season and just a very solid episode. Yeah,
it really is. I think though, Annie, that your opinion previously about it being kind of meh is not an uncommon one. I think that it's not an episode that seems to get a lot of attention. So I think that a lot of folks have kind of this kind of meh feeling about it. So we're going to see if we can sort of bring those folks along the same journey that you've come on and that they'll see the wonder of it as well.
Yeah, I mean, seriously, I would highly recommend everybody to rewatch it if you haven't watched it in a long time. And I was just really glad to. I mean, and I know I have rewatched the whole series fairly recently, but I don't remember just being this engrossed. Well done, Jen. Yeah. Nice pick.
I've always been a big fan of Little Green Men. But, you know, it was partly because of the order in which I watched the episodes, of course, because I watched them as they aired. And because we had gotten so little MSR at that stage, we only got tiny little tidbits. The MSR that we got in Little Green Men really stood out to me at the time. Still does.
Yeah.
And that kind of put it over the top for me. And of course, the plot's really cool too, I think. So that's why I love it. And I should point out that this is perhaps the only season premiere that not written by Chris Carter. I love you, Chris Carter, but this one was written by Glenn Morgan and James Wong. And I tend to really like their mythology episodes because they also wrote EBE, which is another one of my very favorite episodes of all time. So I like what they do with the mythology. They tend to be more character focused writers. And I think that they just write a style of mythology episode that I tend to really like.
I agree with that. And you're right. It is the only one that Carter did not do, right? The only, I would say, finale or opener. It does show. I think that there's a lot paid attention to in this episode in terms of characterization and in terms of like they're in a different place. It's interesting. I mean, we can get right into this and we could talk about Mulder, because I feel like in this season, especially in the early season two, we're following Mulder now a little bit more than we were in season one. Whereas I feel like season one, we were sort of following Scully. Like, I feel like we were kind of getting her side of the things. I feel like now we're into season two. We get it. We believe now as a viewer, like we believe. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I feel like we're kind of now on the Mulder aspect. Like we're following him. He's very sort of, he's kind of a dick in this episode. Would you agree with that? But he's depressed and he's a little disillusioned. Oh. And I mean, we know what happens to Mulder when he does not have the X-Files. Like we don't necessarily get to see a lot of evidence of it, but we definitely get to see the fallout of that, which I assume is what happens later in leading up into the revival, is, you know, you see here, it's a good example of what happens to him without the X-Files.
This is consistent characterization for Mulder, that he gets depressed when he doesn't have the X-Files, and a depressed Mulder is kind of a bitchy Mulder and not a super fun guy to be around.
Right.
Which, I mean, hey, that's what being depressed will do to you. It can make you not a super fun person to be around. Mm-hmm. And so I understand that. And it's a struggle. It's a struggle for Scully to stay with him and to keep supporting him, which she does to her credit in this episode.
Yes.
Scully is so there for him, even though he's barely there for himself.
Right.
She's totally there for him. And you can see, again, the seeds of that relationship being planted, that Scully will be there for Mulder even when he's going through tough times. Eventually, that well runs dry, but it's understandable because she's been doing it for so long. And even this early, she's having to kind of carry him when he's not really able to carry himself.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it doesn't necessarily, speak to her characterization, you know, 12 years, how many years later? More, even more than that, 16 years later or whatever it is, for her to finally have just, given everything that she has to give. But it is very interesting to see that, knowing what's to come. I feel like a lot of these episodes I'm seeing in kind of a different light now, mm-hmm. knowing mm-hmm. what's to come. And that's an interesting thing. But in terms of Mulder's arc, I feel like he... In this, like, even throughout the beginning, like I said, of season two, like, he goes into, what is the host next, and then Blood, yep. and then into the abduction arc for Scully. Like, I feel like, and again, a great deal of this has to do with Scully's pregnancy behind the scenes, or Gillian Anderson's pregnancy behind the scenes. I know she didn't have as much to do. That's also, you know, production issues. But I do mm-hmm. like the idea that we're now sort of following him, and we're in his disillusionment because we're just as frustrated as he is. You know, we want the X-Files back. Come on.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we see where he's coming from. He doesn't seem sort of irrationally petulant or anything like that. It's like, we totally see where he's coming from. And Gillian Anderson's pregnancy led to so many creative decisions that wouldn't have happened otherwise. Mm-hmm. And the idea of telling so much of season two from Mulder's point of view is probably one of them, but like so many of those decisions, it turns out to be a great one. Yeah. And you're absolutely right that Scully was sort of our conduit, no pun intended, into sort of viewing the X-Files in season one. And she was kind of, you know, helped the audience as a way into that world. And we don't need that as much now. And now we can focus on Mulder a bit more and find out his story and his motivations. And this is a really great character study, this episode, of Mulder especially, of Mulder and Scully's relationship as well.
Yeah.
All about Mulder and sort of that disillusionment and doubting himself, as well as sort of doubting where things are going for him. But he's not even sure about what he has seen. He's not sure that he can even trust himself anymore or his own beliefs. He's at a really low ebb. This is a similar Mulder, I think, to the Mulder we see in season five, when he really does lose his faith for about half the season or so then.
Yeah.
This is, again, kind of planting the seeds for that, because he's already showing that his faith can get lost briefly.
Yeah. And not to harken back to this, but also the truth.
Absolutely.
It's another example.
Absolutely. So, this is, again, you know, consistent Mulder characterization. This is kind of what happens to him when he's at a low ebb. He tends to lose that faith. And as always, it seems that Scully is really the one here that kind of helps him to get that back, largely. You know, at the near the beginning of the episode, you know, they're meeting up in the Watergate parking garage, of all places. Mulder's all like, "What do you want to? Have you got like something serious to tell me?" And she's like, "No, I just wanted to like check
she's
on
like,
you.
I
dude.
Just wanted to say, hey, what's up, man?
Like, yeah, since like you're ignoring me otherwise." And it's like, that is super sweet. That first of all, that she's making that effort to reach out to him when he's clearly, you know, not doing much to reach out to her, probably.
Yeah.
And not making it a super appealing prospect, probably, to reach out to him. But she's making that effort. And she's the one that says to him in that course of that conversation, "Don't give up." There's that theme, that X-Files theme that we see throughout the whole series. Don't give up. And she's the one that's bringing it at this stage. And she kind of sticks with that throughout the episode. And by the end of the episode, Mulder has largely found his faith again. And I think it is mostly because of Scully that she believes in him, you know. It's the way it always is with Mulder and Scully. When one stops believing, the other one maybe believes all the more. And that maybe when Mulder doesn't believe in himself, Scully believes in him enough that he can keep going.
Yeah, I think that's actually that's a really good take. I totally buy it. To your point earlier about the meeting in the Watergate, I don't want to bring up Diana Fowley again, but I have to.
Oh,
because
my God. Isn't bring up Diana Fowley?
Isn't that where she lived? Like the Watergate.
Shit,
it was like the
it
Watergate
is.
Apartments. Sorry.
It is.
Okay. We're not talking about her anymore, but I had to bring it up because
I
did so much research recently that when that came up, I'm like, shit, really?
But trigger alert, Diana Fowley. Jeez.
I'm sorry. But here's a good thing. Here's a good thing. I was going to bring up. I love the little the parallel of her in this parking garage saying don't give up to him. Yeah. And then when you think in the revival, in My Struggle 1, when she's going to her car in the parking garage and he has written on her car, "Don't give up."
Yeah.
And I think that was a beautiful little sort of parallel, little callback to this scene, because it, I mean, and again, maybe it's a coincidence, whatever, but it's a great one. It's a great one. And these coincidences happen so often that I have to stop believing that they're coincidences.
Yeah, so, absolutely. That's, but I definitely think about those two scenes as being kind of bookends.
Yeah, it's a really nice movie.
I like it.
It's, and it also feels kind of, it feels kind of similar, but the roles are slightly reversed. Like, their attitudes are still somewhat similar, maybe not Scully's, but obviously Mulder is still sort of in this down and out place. But he's trying to get her to not give up, like to keep to keep looking. And I like I like that little role reversal. I thought that was really nice.
Yeah,
I was going to ask you about the. The little picture of Samantha with the Post-it on it. Like, obviously they had made this sort of like, hey, okay, if we need to talk, if you find some information, if you have something that you want to talk about that's in secret, we have this whole predetermined location that we meet, and we have this little system with the Post-it note. And I'm wondering, like, how that conversation came about, and obviously they have never used it before.
Did they never use it before?
Well, it makes me think they haven't, because he's like, "Well, what do you have?" And she's like, "I don't have anything. I just wanted to talk to you." Like, it makes me think that, like, she hasn't called him down there before to give him, like, new information. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. So, yeah,
I mean,
no.
It's just interesting. I think that whole scene, I think, says a lot about their quote-unquote friendship and how they're not quite there yet. If that makes sense. Like, I feel like she's trying to be friends with him. Like, she's trying to be a good friend to him.
Yes.
And whether he knows it or not, like, he is still kind of trying to keep it very professional, I think.
Yeah. I don't know if he's so much trying to keep it professional, but it just seems to be, that's all he can seem to conceive is that he and his work are one and the same. And
why would she want to see me if it weren't about work?
Why would you want to see me otherwise?
Yeah.
Although I like in that scene, I mean, first of all, I don't know how they know what time to meet. It's a blank post-it.
Right.
But so you'd think you could at least, like, write a number 6 or
something. Well, maybe it was predetermined.
They obviously, had a conversation at some point. Now someone should write this fanfic where they meet. Where did they meet to make this decision? What was going on there? Was that at a coffee shop? Did she stop by Mulder's place to check on him and this whole came up? Yeah. I really want to know how this came to pass, because I hadn't thought of it before, but now I am.
Yeah.
And I like that scene in the parking garage, because at the beginning, it is very almost contentious, where Mulder's like, "Well, screw you if you're not here to give me information." Yeah. But in the course of that conversation, he starts to open up a little bit to Scully, talking about, "Oh, they've got me on this jerk off job of, you know, listening in on
guys and strippers and
guys talking about strippers." And he's like, you can see him kind of like, there's like a moment in that conversation where he does start to open up, and he kind of like sinks into sort of a sitting position, and Scully like crouches right down there with him, and he starts to open up to her. So it does turn into more of a sort of friendship exchange. Mm-hmm. So Scully is able to kind of bring him out of that a little bit. So he's got it in him to do it. He just needs a little bit of prodding. So
yeah, I don't mean to like denigrate their friendship. I'm just saying that I like the slow progression. I think that you can definitely see a difference here in their relationship than you can say after one breath. You know what I mean? Like, there's a difference. And I think it's an interesting thing to point out, just because, like, we talk about the wonderful, like, MSR in this episode, how it is still just being very carefully doled out.
It's being very carefully doled out. It's very subtle. There's, like, it's still very much a question about what exactly is their connection to each other. Is it, you know, are they even friends is even a question. And I feel like even in the course of this episode, quite a lot is established in terms of Scully's role in Mulder's life outside of work, because this is something new that they have to kind of navigate and establish for the season. And in this episode, that's kind of established. I feel like there's a whole sort of arc, even within this episode, of Mulder at the beginning of the episode kind of feeling like he has nothing. And, you know, he talks a lot about, "I don't have any evidence," all that sort of thing. He feels like because he has no evidence, he's a failure. But by the end of the episode, we see that he's more hopeful, that that he appreciates the role that Scully plays in his life. But that's, I mean, you know, that's a pretty subtle sort of movement, but it's movement nevertheless. Mm-hmm. And it's just establishing them even as friends outside of work, which we haven't even established yet.
Right.
So even that kind of thing being established was like a big deal back then. So that was, I liked that aspect. It reminds me of one in the middle of that episode. I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but I always find it so weird, but it kind of makes some sense when you think about where the relationship it is when Scully arrives in Puerto Rico and Mulder is passed out and Scully's like trying to sort of like bring him around. And she says to Mulder, it's Scully, Dana Scully.
Yeah.
You'll have no clue who she is.
Well, I mean, let's cut her a little bit of slack. She's a doctor, right? She's trying to make sure that like he can like even know who he is, like that he hasn't knocked his head out or doesn't have some sort of head injury, right? But again, that also goes to my earlier point that like they're at this point in the series, they're not as close as they eventually get.
Yeah, because there's no way she would, no matter how conked out he was, there's no way she'd say it's Scully, Data Scully in like season 4 or 5 or
right,
something like
right.
that.
It was very, that was very Bond, James Bond.
Yeah.
You're right. That stood out to me too as funny. But I do think she's just being doctor. I think she's just like
probably being quite doctor. And it didn't stand out to me at the time. I mean, at the time, I don't think we were kind of like your friends. Why are you saying that? Because at that point, they did largely still have a professional relationship. So it made sense. So
and they're not partners anymore. You know, they've been apart. I would assume for a few months. I mean, according to my handy dandy timeline, this is all happening in July, and I believe I don't remember when the X-Files closed, but I want to say it's been a good 2 or 3 months, you know, that they haven't been working together, you know?
Yeah, yeah. They're sort of established in their new assignments.
Right. So it's not too terribly awful to me that she's saying her full name. Like, hey, remember me? Oh. Hey, remember me? Like, I think it's kind of cute.
No, I think it is. And like I say, at the time, it didn't seem at all strange. I think it just seems strange in retrospect, knowing how close they became. It seems odd that she was ever saying that.
Yeah.
But at the time, it didn't seem terribly odd. And so it's only sort of years later that I just kind of laugh every time it happens. If it happens in July, I guess that explains why. Is that why Mulder is sweating the whole time?
Well,
sweating.
We will get to that. We've skipped a lot. Let's go back a little bit. I have a technical question for you because I do like this sort of continuity, I should say, of when Mulder and Scully are not on the X-Files, they're up in the bullpen and they're doing they're doing different desk jobs. You know, we see this again in season 6 when the X-Files are shut down. And also, did you notice that Scully is in some kind of office at one point? And
I did not notice that.
And
it's
the same. I think it's the same room that we see her in a different season 1 episode where she's doing research similar, like maybe she's doing a field report or something. And I think it kind of further supports the theory that Scully has her own office, at least at this point in the series. Like she's not sharing an office with Mulder. Like she goes, she like kind of, I don't want to say reports to him because again, that sounds like she's a subordinate, but she kind of goes down to like
meet with him.
Yeah. And I know people like give the show a lot of shit because they say, oh, it's not Scully and Mulder's office, but it isn't. It becomes their office, but it is Mulder's office.
Yeah.
And I think Scully, especially in the first couple seasons, she has her own like random office that we see her in occasionally.
Okay.
See it in its full glory later this season. And I'll definitely point that out when that happens.
Yes.
So you might know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point.
Yeah.
She has her own office, but, you know, she doesn't want to hang out in there any more than she has to. When the X-Files was around, of course she wants to hang out down at Mulder's place because that's where the action is and that's where Mulder is.
I bring it up because there's a lot of debate out there about like how terrible it is that Scully doesn't have her own desk. And a lot of the time I want to say, you know, well, she does, at least at the beginning. Yeah. We see she has one and she's got her own office. So
she's got a whole office and it's probably way better than Mulder's.
Yeah, it seems to just evolve that they end up just sharing an office. That's kind of how it ends up, which is appropriate for their relationship.
I Well, exactly. I wonder if she loses that office eventually. It was probably like there was like some kind of a space inventory like they always seem to have at the university where I work, where they're like, is someone using this office? Because if they're not, we're going to take it for something else. So maybe that's what happened. She just lost it eventually.
Yeah, yeah. We'll have to talk about that as the episodes progress. I just think that's really funny.
Very good point.
Another thing that we should talk about before we get to Puerto Rico is Senator Matheson.
Oh God, yes. Let's not forget Senator Matheson.
The whole cold open of this episode is really cool because we get to see like Voyager 1 circling around, and we actually get some learning, don't we, Jen? Like
we get some learning.
We get some nice learnings from Mulder, but later we also get some from Senator Matheson. And I love this relationship or this sort of dynamic that the two of them have. Mm. And it's more, to me, I almost find it more interesting than his relationship with Deep Throat, because Matheson to me appears like he really wants to help. Like he really wants to be helping Mulder. Yeah. He wants Mulder to find the truth, whereas Deep Throat always sort of felt like, I'm doing this because I feel obligated. Like I feel like I have to, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. To kind of, it's like Deep Throat already knew all or most of the answers, and he was just trying to get Mulder to sort of find them out so he could sort of air them to the public. Yeah. Whereas Senator Matheson is finding it at the same time as Mulder.
He's just as curious.
He's like a UFO nerd, and he just wants to sort of work with Mulder to kind of uncover what's going on here, and he just happens to be the powerful guy that can sort of help Mulder out.
Right. Like I have in my head canon, I think that Matheson is a member of the syndicate or is somehow working with the syndicate, but he's in much the same way as Deep Throat. He's kind of trying to use his power for good. One of those people who's kind of trying to get out just because of the power that he does have. I think that it's likely that he could be a syndicate member. And then what happens to him later down the road, when we get to season six, we'll be talking more about Senator Matheson because we don't see him again for several years, probably for a good reason.
It's nice while we have him. He's a handsome man. I'll call him a silver fox.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And great taste in music.
Speaking of Fox.
Brack Vandenberg Concerto. Yeah, speaking of Fox, yes.
He calls him Fox.
He does call him Fox. I get a kind of a father-son vibe between those two. I mean, there was always that kind of between Deep Throat and Mulder as well. Obviously, Mulder, you know, has some issues with his dad and tends to kind of be looking for father figures. And I get that sense, like when Mulder says, Mulder just sounds so sad when he says, I've let you down.
Yeah.
And I don't think Senator Matheson's too wound up about it, but Mulder just seems like, oh my God, there's a lot of like emotional sort of involvement in that relationship, at least on Mulder's side, perhaps less so on Matheson's side. So I definitely get that sort of father-son vibe between them.
Like the stakes feel high for Mulder in this relationship or in this, patron, what would it be called? Mentor sort of situation.
And Mulder just really wants to do well. He just desperately seems to emotionally need that for some reason. And he just feels bad when he can't.
And it's also, I think it's canonically established. Sorry, I can't roll that word off my tongue fast enough. Road that at least in 1990, we know that Mulder is estranged from his father. And when I say father, I mean Bill Mulder. For good reason, but we know that they are somehow estranged. He obviously does not have like a strong father figure in his life. Like I think it's highly likely that when he sees Bill Mulder in, what would that be, Anasazi? Is that when we meet Bill Mulder?
I think so.
No, maybe it's in Colony. We meet him in Colony.
Yeah. Colony.
That's maybe the first time they've spoken in several years. I think it's very possible because, you know, Mulder goes in for the hug and he's got the handshake.
Yeah.
So Mulder's obviously got some daddy issues. And I think we can see that here in this scene, too, that he's, yeah, like you said, the stakes are high. He really wants to be, he wants to impress him. He wants to do something that's going to, and he also wants his funds, too. Let's be real.
Yeah, of course.
Obviously, he's, you know, supporting him. He's got the money and he's got the power. And
he's got the connections and the information and all those things. Yeah. So, I mean, he gives him really valuable information. And it doesn't feel like it's one of those kind of I'm jerking you around slightly kind of tips that Deep Throat would always give. You never really knew whether Deep Throat was giving a straight tip or kind of a jerking around tip, because I mean he had done both. Right. But Senator Matheson seems pretty sincere, and it does turn out to be a really sort of valid tip that he gives him. So,
yeah,
I like Senator Matheson.
Senator Matheson, he kind of passes, he passes muster. He passes the sniff test in this episode because everything he said to Mulder was true, you know? And as far as I can tell, like, I think he even warned them that you're going to have a certain amount of time and then the berets are going to show up and then you need to get the hell out of there. Like, everything he said kind of came to pass. So I think
valuable information.
Right. And so as we leave this episode, it seems like he is still an extremely valuable informant that we don't really hear from again. And we can talk about that when we get to the end of the episode. But before we head on to the next scene, I wanted to mention that they do talk about Voyager. I mentioned that earlier in the opening, and they talk about the record, the golden record, with the Bok and everything. And that does make an appearance, obviously, in the revival in the Lost Art of Forehead Sweat.
It does. You're
when they
right.
they come upon the crashed Voyager with the golden record. I just thought that
so
was
sad.
Yeah, but I just thought that again was another nice little callback. Very nice.
Yeah, it is. And I just want to give also just a brief shout out to Morgan and Juan for writing a good monologue for that opening, because I've said several times how much I do not like Chris Carter monologues. And Morgan and Wong have written one that's just a good, straightforward monologue. It's not boring. Like you say, we learn a lot, but it's still well written. It moves the story forward and sets a nice tone, and it shows it can be done.
Yeah, it's a good one. It's a really good one.
I like it.
So before Mulder goes on his journey, let's talk about this flashback, because this is the first time we get some actual video imagery, right?
Yes. It's the first time we see Samantha's abduction for ourselves as the audience.
Right, because even that, the imagery of her getting pulled out the window, this is the first time we see that, correct?
I'm pretty sure it is. Yeah, because up until then, we've only ever heard Mulder's account of it. We've never seen anything.
Right, right. And I wanted to talk about that, too, because I think that we both noticed that there are some, I would say, discrepancies between what's happening here and what Mulder is saying under deep regression hypnosis.
Yes.
And to me, all that means is that he, you know, memory is very faulty. You know, it's not reliable, especially when you're under regression. And I feel like in this very episode, he says that he's beginning to doubt his own memory. He even admits that much to Scully. So I think it's just extremely interesting that we do see that these memories that he is clinging to aren't as solid as we once thought when we heard him talk about them in Conduit. And it's just little tiny details that are different. So, I mean, I can completely chalk that up to memory changes as you grow and you change and you remember things different. What's your take on that?
I think that, absolutely. I think I didn't notice at the time, to be honest, that there was much in the way of differences, because they are pretty subtle. The general story is the same. Samantha was abducted by aliens, and the specifics I was never super concerned about. So it was only sort of after the fact that I realized, oh, this is actually a little bit different. I think that the version that they bring us in Little Green Men is a little bit more exciting. There's a lot more going on. People are yelling, you know, for a television scene. There's a bit more action, which is kind of what you kind of want to have when you're presenting it for the audience. So I think it makes sense to kind of sort of gin it up slightly. Mm-hmm. And I think it works as a scene. I think it works in this particular episode as a parallel to sort of Mulder's encounter with the extraterrestrials that we're going to get to later in Puerto Rico. And so it kind of fleshes out a lot of what the abduction imagery was at the time, that, you know, was, again, sort of people were sort of familiar who were into UFOs about, you know, what did abductions look like typically. And so this kind of fits in with that. And I'm totally fine with that. I'm not at all concerned about the small discrepancies, because like you say, it was only ever Mulder's recollections about it. And again, that's what this is again. We're not necessarily seeing what happened.
No, we're seeing what he is remembering or what
we're seeing. Yeah, this is like the unreliable narrator here. Yeah. And we don't necessarily know for sure this is what happened. We're just seeing Mulder's thoughts. And so even though, you know, there's a tendency when you see something on screen to think that that is an account of what really happened, it's not necessarily in this case. And it's just Mulder's recollection on that particular day of what happened based on, you know, whatever sort of emotional filter he's seeing it through.
Right. And another thing worth pointing out is that in Conduit, what we hear is him going into the hypnosis. And he's actually like going under. He's in the process of being put under and telling the story. And I was always under the impression that Mulder didn't remember, that he'd either blocked it completely.
Yep.
He doesn't have actual memories of this alien abduction thing. In my mind, he got those when he went and was regressed. Because that would make sense for that. That would line up with that, too, that he initially maybe just didn't remember anything exactly like what he's saying in Conduit. Like, I don't see her, but I can hear her. Like, he's kind of just trying to remember what he can and then concocts this entire alien abduction scenario because of the regression, because of all of the things that have been going on with him recently, you know, the timing of that, when that's happening.
Yes.
And so I think that, to me, and that's kind of how deep regression hypnosis works and can be dangerous.
Yes.
Because it can plant false memories. Yeah. And which we know comes to bear out, because we know Samantha wasn't abducted by aliens. Like, we know that's not what happened. And we continue to see different scenarios and hear different scenarios and learn different facts along the way that sort of build up to the ultimate truth about what happened to her. So yeah, totally unreliable narrator, totally like the progression of him being regressed and then his memories changing. But it is a really cool scene, and I think that they did it really well. There's a little bit of a sort of dramatic kind of humorous moment when they do the Samantha.
Maybe that was one step too many, maybe.
Yeah, it reminded me. Yeah, it reminded me of Scully in season 8 going, "No."
It was just one thing too many.
A little too much, because I was on board until then, and then I'm like, "No, don't do the slow motion," because it's almost cliché that it's so bad.
Yeah. And bless those child actors. First of all, that the kid that they got playing Mulder looks amazingly like Mulder.
Yes,
he's cast really well, but I don't know if they're necessarily going to win acting awards, but I'm sure that they were way better actors than I would ever be at any age.
Yeah.
So I think they did a perfectly fine job, and I think they actually had quite a nice chemistry as siblings. So
they totally did.
I think it definitely worked.
It made me think of like my own older brother, and like totally, it was perfect. And I actually wanted to point out that I think the actor playing Mulder, young Mulder, looks just like David Duchovny's son. It's kind of creepy.
Yeah, right.
In real life. Yeah. But it very good casting, very good. And the girl, I wanted to say, I didn't actually open up Paper Hearts to check. I wanted to. To see if her nightdress in this vision actually matched one of those hearts.
Oh, we'll have to check that one.
I'm certain somebody has done this, and I could probably, I can do it tomorrow as soon as I hang up. And I'm going to say it doesn't match either of them.
Because I have a feeling it doesn't.
Yeah. And even if it did, I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean anything, but it is interesting to think of that the Paper Hearts continuity people did go back and look at this scene to see, like, we got to find something that's kind of similar, because I do remember it being very similar to that.
I mean
to the point where I was like, what, wow, was that the same? Like, I actually was trying to remember, but anyway,
it's enough to make you think that it might be the same, which is, you know, good enough,
right? And I also wanted to point out how disturbing it is that one of the last things that Mulder said to his sister was, "Get out of my life."
Oh, I know. That's like really heartbreaking, isn't it?
Right? And how much does he beat himself up over that?
And of course, this is just his recollection. And so the fact that he's specifically remembering saying that is, it just kind of illustrates how much guilt that he's carrying for some reason over this whole situation, almost to the point where he may even have imagined saying that line. And he obviously feels somehow responsible, and he may even be sort of like retconning what happened in his mind to somehow make himself more responsible. Yeah. So,
and I believe that. I absolutely believe that.
It is heartbreaking, though.
Even like the memory, like with the gun, like trying to go for the gun, which I'm sure he did. But then I remember him saying too that he was just paralyzed, which is exactly what would happen, I think, with a kid who was frightened. And I think that I love all the little details, how they kind of add up, and you kind of have to decide which ones really happened, which ones didn't. It's just super, super interesting. I wanted to point out too, sorry, we will eventually get out of the scene, I promise, but there was a picture, like a painting on the wall of it looked like a young Mulder with a dog.
Yes. with a big black dog.
Yeah, and I was for some reason I always had it in my head that they had a dog as kids, but I don't know why. Maybe that was just one of those fanfic canon things that I just thought was real, but I don't think I ever noticed that picture before. And I was like, wow,
I don't think I did either.
They did have a dog at some point.
Yeah.
That dog existed.
They obviously had a dog. Maybe even, I don't know how young Mulder looks. He's definitely younger in that mm-hmm. picture. Could even, the fact that it's just him and the dog, maybe it's even before Samantha was born or something right. like that. So, yeah, well, shout out to the Mulder's big black dog up in Doggy Heaven, because he was obviously a beloved member of the family. They still have a picture of him.
Yeah, we're going to have to think of that name, the name of that dog. We're going to have to
put
a call out to Twitter. Everyone name that dog.
Yeah, name the Mulder's dog.
I'm going to post a picture of the
yeah, do it.
Of the thing, because I certainly never noticed that before, and I couldn't believe it. I was like, what?
Yeah. There's a dog? Yeah, that caught my eye too.
Anyway, so he wakes up from his nightmare, and we get the first introduction of the fish tank.
Is this the first time we see the fish tank?
Yep. Remember we were talking about this, how he did not have it in Erlenmeyer Flask. Now that I think about it, Erlenmeyer Flask was May. That was May. So it's been 2 months. Somewhere in that 2 months, Mulder got himself a fish tank.
Got himself a fish. What's that all about? He just wanted to have a fishy friend.
Yeah, we need that fanfic too.
Anyway. Yeah, do. The fish tank is great. Fish tank is kind of a major part of this episode, in fact. And we do see it in that. That's the first time we see it is in that scene. And I really do love the effect of the lighting in the fish tank. I always love the fish tank.
I am still convinced that's why they did it. I think they wanted to keep Mulder's room dark. They wanted to keep it dark. But after getting through season one, people were like, you guys, it's just too fucking dark. Like, we need some more light. And they're like, no, we don't want light. And they're like, no, we got to find a way to make this more light. And that was what they came up with. I am convinced.
This is not a light that Mulder would have turned on. He still wants to sit in the dark, but there has to be a light coming from a source.
Yeah.
And Fishy needs a light. So we have the fish tank, and it always looks really cool. So it adds a lot of visual interest to his apartment, which would be sorely lacking otherwise.
Yeah. Yep. So let's talk about Scully for a little bit. Let's talk about her.
Yes, let's.
Like, kind of, Skinner's obviously wondering where Mulder is. He's disappeared. He's gone off to Puerto Rico. He's asking Scully, and Scully seems to genuinely not know.
Which we only hear as a recording that he plays for a cigarette smoking man. So obviously they're trying to keep Gillian Anderson's workload as light as possible. So she's just doing a quick voiceover for that scene, which is still good. But she is obviously genuinely worried about him. And Skinner obviously can tell
that she's
worried.
I think that's a cool little detail, because it definitely surveillance sort of continues even with Skinner. Like, I'm reminded of like way in like the Biogenesis arc, when Skinner is videotaping their meeting, and then Mulder can read his mind and knows that he's betrayed them or is talking to somebody else. And like the idea that Skinner is, he's doing what he has to do because he's got Smoking Man on his back. But you can start to see sort of the cracks in that relationship. Mm-hmm. And Skinner, even this early, this is like the second scene we have with Skinner. The first one was Tombs, right?
Yep.
In terms of the scenes with Skinner and Smoking Man, I believe.
Yes.
And in this one, like, you see like a hint of it, like even just by him saying, I don't smoke. It's sort of like a delineation, like, hey, you smoke. You're the bad guy. I'm not the bad guy. I even just the tiny little things like that, I think, is great.
Yeah. The way that Mitch Pileggi plays those scenes is always so great, because there's this sense that, you know, he's doing his job. He's doing what he has to do. But there's just a tiny hint that he's none too happy about it. And it's very subtle, although less subtle by the end of the episode, which I'm sure we will get to as well.
Yeah.
But I always love scenes with Skinner and CSM, because there's always such an interesting tension going on between them. And CSM thinks he has more power every time he's in that room than he actually does, which is always kind of cool.
Yeah, I love to see Skinner sort of asserting his power over, like, he really knows that at the end of the day, Smoking Man has the power, but he is not going to let it stand, like, all the time. He's going to be like, look, I cannot let every bit of my power go, not in my own office. So it's like, I don't smoke. And then I think at a certain point, he's got the no smoking sign. And like, he's slowly sort of, it's these little bits of defiance. Yeah. And I love to see it.
Yeah, little bits. I think that's really well put. Little bits of defiance. He sort of picks his moments and, you know, he knows when to push it. And I always love it when Skinner does that. So, yeah, I love the presence of Skinner in this episode. It definitely adds to it.
So Scully goes to Mulder's apartment. She's looking for him. We got to talk about this, Jen.
Because we definitely have to talk about this.
What is the deal with this phone message? What is the deal? Because first of all, whoever this woman is, and we could talk about who we think this is,
yeah.
calls him Mulder, first of all.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. She does call him Mulder, not Fox.
Nothing seems to be consistent in the Fox and the Mulder calling. I have to say.
No, there doesn't.
I need to make a list of who calls him what, because I feel like there really isn't a consistency. But
it's very inconsistent.
She says, "You hounded me to have lunch, and then you didn't show. You're a pig." It's the best message ever, and it's so small and short, and it's like a tiny little insight into his personal life, which is not going very well, clearly. Yeah. But
well, I mean, it was well enough to get her to agree to lunch in the first place.
Right. Well, I can't. Here's the thing. I wonder if a lot of this is in this woman's head, because I cannot imagine Mulder hounding anyone to go to lunch.
Oh, I can't really. I don't know what is going on there. I mean,
it strikes me as like she's making it up. Like he said in passing, "Hey, let's go grab lunch." And she interpreted that to be, "Oh, you hounded me to have lunch because you really." And then, of course, he doesn't show because he's got other things on his mind and he's got X-Files to solve. And then she gets really pissed. I love it. You're a pig. Like, and she doesn't even. No allowance for being stood up. Like, no allowance.
None. You go, girl. You just, you know, you set your boundaries. That's what I say. Value yourself. If a man doesn't show up, then he is a pig.
Who do you think this is, Jen?
I am dying to know. I'm inclined to think, I have a hard time imagining it's anyone other than a woman that he is trying to get the attention of, I think. The voice that was cast, the woman that was cast to do the voice, to me, it's a sexy voice.
Yeah.
And she sounds like someone who's got some womanly wiles. So I'm inclined to think, I don't know about hounding, but maybe a couple of times he asked somebody out for lunch. I mean, it's not like a super serious date because they're going for lunch, not dinner.
Right.
I think the point is that he didn't show because he's in Puerto Rico, and that's how Scully knows he's not there. It's just, I feel like it kind of emphasizes, oh my God, he hounded this sexy woman for lunch and didn't show. It must be serious.
Yeah.
And now he's never going to get another chance with her again because now she says he's a pig. And I love that she's not like crying about it or even like really mad.
It's very matter of fact.
Just very matter of fact. You're a pig, just so you know. And I love her. I don't know who the mystery woman is, but I love her. And I love her as a strong woman.
Yeah, and I love Scully's reaction to it too, because at first it's kind of like confusion, like who's he talking to? And then after, it's almost, she doesn't quite roll her eyes, but she almost does. It's almost just kind of like, oh well, who do you think this is, lady? You think he's got time for a social life? Jeez.
And it's all, I think she always,
I can't even get him to meet me in a parking garage for a friendly chat. Yeah,
exactly. She kind of almost raises her eyebrows a little bit at the start of the message, too. I don't get a sense that there's like jealousy going on here. She's not going all like, not to mention her. And now I'm doing it. It's not like it's Diana Fowley or something like that. It's just at this stage, it's kind of like in the season one episode Fire, where she's more like, it's the eye rolling stage when she sees Mulder making a fool of himself over a chick.
Yeah.
It's just like, oh, dude, please.
Making a fool of yourself again. Oh, jeez.
Making a fool of yourself again. Whoever this woman was, she was probably out of your league, and now she's never going to give you another chance. Yeah. And that's the end of that. So, I love it. I love the moment. It's plot-wise, I think it's there just to kind of further establish that Mulder has gone away unexpectedly. But they really took it as far as they could. It's just, the you're a pig part is a great line. It's a classic line in X-Men history, in my opinion.
Very, very, very funny. And just so, like, not Mulder that it just makes me laugh that it's in this episode. Because
I
love those moments where we're like, they have this entirely other life that we never get to see. that yeah. it's just so cool to get those teeny glimpses into it.
Yeah.
But
and I think it would be at this stage, maybe in the early seasons, I think Mulder had a little teeny tiny bit of a social life occasionally. And this is like one hint that, you know,
he at least tried.
He was trying. Yeah. He made an effort.
Yeah.
Even though he screwed it up when he went to go looking for aliens in Puerto Rico. And that right. was the end of that. That's why he can't have ladies in his life. Because he runs off to Puerto Rico without any notice, and only people like Scully will put up with that kind of shit.
Exactly.
And she's there, and of course, and that's where the fish tank comes in as a plot point.
Yes.
Because within, she's only there to feed his fish.
Right.
And that's her explanation to those guys who are like surveilling Mulder's apartment. I don't really know why she couldn't have just said, well, we're friends and I hear that he's missing. So I thought I'd come in just to see if there's any indication about where he went. I mean, to me, that seems like a perfectly rational explanation. Yeah. But you have to come up with this whole fish feeding story.
Almost more suspicious that she's not worried. Like, you think she'd be like, where is he? I don't know where he is. Where is he? Where is Mulder? Are you under here? Where are you?
I'm just here to feed his fish.
Yeah.
And of course, then she uses that as this whole sort of ruse to get her hands back on that piece of paper that's been thrown into the garbage. And all I can think now is, don't throw away pieces of paper. That's recyclable.
Well, you know, 1995 or whatever. Yeah. But
which is a very 90s scene with that whole computer with like, I think that's like an actual DOS operating system that she's using. I love the 90s-ishness of that.
Oh, God. And the trust no one password. Nice little bit of continuity there, too, right?
Yeah, definitely, though. the idea that you would guess trust no one isn't completely unbelievable. But the part that gets me is that she knows to use the numeral one.
Yeah, it's a little, very, very like.
It's
very 90s. I don't know how else to describe it. It's very 90s to me. Like, that would be the password of this little DOS operating system. But anyway.
It's not case sensitive either, because all the passwords are all in uppercase, I noticed. So back in the days when we didn't need case passwords, and life was a lot easier, quite frankly.
Well, if she had written it out, it would have said trust noon. And that doesn't look good, because whoever noon is, we don't trust that person. So
that's true.
Right. Okay.
Looks like a much cooler password with no one.
I'm
sure tons of X-Files back in the day made that their password after seeing that, because it's a pretty good password. It has a number in it, and it's not a regular word that you find in the dictionary. So it's actually a pretty strong password.
It is pretty good. There was one more thing I was going to say about that scene. Well, I mean, I do like the idea that Scully is. We can see her paranoia come out. I like anytime you see that she's actually genuinely believing that something is up and these guys cannot get a hold of this paper, because then they're going to find Mulder before I do. And the fact that she's paranoid about that, I think, shows some interesting character development for Scully. And like we saw it a bit in Erlenmeyer Flask. So it's also nice to see that she's not completely backsliding in that. She's still trying to maintain, you know, she's in the airport, like looking in her little compact, and she's like, she's worried people are around, you know, she's got that air of paranoia that we didn't see a whole lot in season one. Like, we saw more eye rolling and skepticism, but now she's like, this shit's real. So I like that sort of transition with her.
Yeah, I agree. I love paranoid Scully. And we get plenty of that in this episode. I mean, all the stuff in the airport's very reminiscent to me of EBE, where she and Mulder are trying to sort of, they're up to airport shenanigans so that they don't get followed. And
you
get that again here. I love airport shenanigans. It's just I always find it super exciting. And I'm just very impressed when Scully pulls it off.
Airport shenanigans.
Airport shenanigans are my favorite kind of shenanigans.
I do love it. I wanted to give a shout out, and I don't know his name. I could not find it, to the guy who's doing the whole scene with the wow signal. Because
he's great, isn't he?
He put in a hell of a performance, I gotta say. Right?
Yes.
He's believable.
At the U.S. Naval Observatory.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a name on screen.
Yeah, I was looking for him, and I couldn't find him. And if anyone knows who that is, please let us know so we can give him a proper shout out. But he did a great job. I was just like, this guy's really into it, and it doesn't feel at all over the top. Like, he feels genuinely excited. Like, I buy it completely. Anyway,
totally.
He did a great job.
Because that could have been a pretty boring scene. It's really just kind of exposition, but the way he played it and the way they shot it, where he's kind of like walking around the office and he's clearly like, you know, it's a very sort of classic academic type where, you know, he tries to be Mr. Serious Man, but he just can't help his kind of inner nerd from coming out when he gets excited.
Yeah.
And Yeah, he was great. That was a great little scene. I wonder if that had been a little in a later season, if that would have been a scene with the lone gunman rather than with this nameless man at the U.S. Naval Observatory. But I'm glad we got to see him, even if it was only for one nameless scene.
Yeah, you're right. It does seem like the kind of scene. I mean, she doesn't quite trust the gunman yet or know them well enough, but it does seem like the kind of scene in a later episode she would have definitely gone to the gunman to find out. But I like, again, the progression of that. Like, she doesn't, she's not there yet with the gunman. She still thinks they're wacko, you know, so.
She goes to this
credentialed guy who knows what he's talking about, and I
That's very Scully.
Yeah, I like
that's it. It's very early season two Scully for sure.
So, are you ready to head over to Arecibo, Puerto Rico?
Oh, let's go.
Do it. The first thing I need to say about all of these Puerto Rico scenes, something that you brought up before, is that the gray T-shirt experience has, shall we say, evolved.
It really has. It's a different level.
It's on a whole new level. We not only have like the cut off sleeves, but we have like the enormous gobs of sweat.
It's just sweating constantly.
Well, I mean, it is Puerto Rico. It's rather humid, and it is July. So I buy it that he's that hot and sweaty. But he is quite hot. And quite sweaty.
Quite hot and quite sweaty. Most definitely. It's just, I have to say, when I was watching the episode today again. Here in Edmonton, it's very cold and very dry at this time of year. And so to see something that looks like something that was hot and humid, I was like, yes, just I want to bask in it. Mm-hmm. I could really stand that heat and humidity right now. So I really enjoyed it vicariously.
It was definitely very moist in that ante room.
It was super moist in the ante room with that one. Although, when Scully shows up, of course, she looks fragrant as always. She's not sweating.
Her hair looks way too good for the Puerto Rico humidity.
Seriously, mine would be a total frizz, but Scully always looks awesome, of course.
But before Scully shows up, let's talk a little bit about our friend Jorge Concepcion. Jorge. Poor Jorge. He's one of these sort of like guy of the weeks that I felt like really sorry for, because we never really know him very well. We don't really know what he's afraid of. Like, I know a little bit of Spanish, so I can kind of understand what he's saying. He's obviously saying there's lights in the sky and there's men, and he's describing essentially like, I like the parallel because he's describing essentially what Mulder saw when Samantha got abducted. So, of course, we're having not only all of his work with extraterrestrials, he's making that connection, too, at that moment. And so everything that he's saying, he's just completely going to believe. And I absolutely believe that Jorge did see something. And I was going to ask you, because we see it, too. Obviously, there's something. But what do you think happens to him? Like, do you think he is just scared to death? Because I notice when Mulder finds him, he's against this tree and there's like a slash mark on the tree. I don't know if you noticed that. Like above his head.
Yeah, it seems it's very mysterious. Mm-hmm. I think that at the time I kind of thought, okay, since Mulder comes to the conclusion that it's like he's been frightened to death, then that's good enough for me. Talking about amping up the tension and fear level of that whole scenario, it's like, what did he see that literally scared him to death?
Right.
And so I kind of bought the it scared him to death thing, although it's obviously a little over the top, but
he was already so scared. Yeah.
He was pretty scared. Now I have a question for you. Who the heck is Jorge? Like, where did he come from? What's he doing there? I don't really know if we get any kind of an explanation. Like, I always kind of assumed he was like a maintenance guy or something, just kind of based on how he's dressed, but I'm not sure if there's any explanation.
Because you know what's interesting to me? I've never really thought about that. I just thought he was just some guy who was like maybe snooping around the area and he was just curious.
Right.
Like,
and maybe he is.
Yeah. But the idea that it's almost like maybe he's like one of those UFO hunters. Like, it's possible.
And
that gives it a whole nother layer, because maybe what we thought he was seeing, he didn't see. And he wanted to see it in the same way that Mulder did.
Yeah, that's possible.
Which, you know, again, it always brings it back to this sort of unreliable narrator and what we are seeing real. And it's always hard to know and hard to tell. And there's also the possibility that he was somehow murdered. Like, maybe there's one of CSM's minions in the woods who is obviously not going to kill Mulder, because they don't ever kill Mulder, but will need to silence another witness.
Yeah.
And
that's entirely possible.
Yeah, it would have been a kind of cool thing, since I think that's entirely likely. It would have been cool to maybe see someone lurking in the woods, like, after Mulder escaped. But, you know, again, it leaves it completely open-ended. We don't know what happened. But there is that sort of strange strike on the tree. You should check it out if you missed it. That is just kind of right above his head, almost like a bullet. It almost looks like maybe a bullet went by. But he obviously didn't get shot. I mean, so I don't know. It's very strange. And, like, even Mulder can't kind of determine what killed him. I mean, he's no Scully. He's not doing an autopsy or anything, so he doesn't know. But
he's doing his best.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess we can chalk that up to just he doesn't really know what he's looking for. But I'm sure Mulder would know if there was a giant bullet hole in the guy's head. So,
I think we can rule that out.
But
there's nothing obvious. There's no obvious sign of death. Right. So, yeah, Mulder's just guessing. It's, you know, it's like he's been scared to death. That's the best he can come up with. But, you know, it would probably... If we were to do a proper autopsy, it would turn out he'd had like cardiac arrest or something like that, something a bit more scientific, but it's still essentially frightened to death.
Exactly.
In essence, that's kind of the way I sort of took that.
I love the idea.
It just raises the stakes when, like, oh my gosh, now someone's dead.
Yeah, exactly. And again, he's also like alone, even though he went there alone. Yeah. Like it's kind of a scary feeling to have somebody and then suddenly be alone again.
Yeah.
So that kind of adds, I think, to the terror of it. But I also think it's really cute how they slowly sort of reveal that he's making these tapes for Scully. Like, we don't really know. I remember when I first watched this, I remember having a moment where I was like, oh, my heart, he's making those tapes for her. Like, because I think he's just recording his experience. Like, he's just talking and he's telling himself what's happening just so he can remember it for later. But then I'm like, no, he's going to send this to Scully. Like, he wants her to figure it out. Like, I just love that.
Scully, it's still one of my favorite moments in the episode. And at the time, it was kind of like we were in shipper heaven. Like, oh, my God, they're making for Scully. Because it is like not reveal. It sounds like he's just making notes for himself or something up until that moment. But it's right after Jorge is killed and Mulder's, you know, trying to figure out the cause of death. And that's when he says, my God, Scully, it's as though he's been frightened to death. Yeah. And that I still every time go, oh, my God, it's so Scully. Yeah. It's just so sweet somehow that like he's thinking of her.
It is.
And, you know, even though he's off doing his Mulder thing, he's still thinking of Scully. And this is actually for her. So that's the fact that he's, you know, bringing her into this, even when she's not present, is to me, I just love that.
It's important, too, because I think without that tiny moment and that tiny line that's telling us kind of what's informing all of these tapes, he could come off really badly on this entire episode, because it does seem like a classic example of Mulder running off to do shit on his own, you know, but he is involving her in this way. And I like that. I do like that they put that in there because it could have very easily gone the other way. So
it's really excellent. I love that moment. So yeah, it's just one of those little magical moments in Little Green Men that I love. So yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
It's very sweet. And then we get like terrific sort of like really sort of shippy monologues from there on out in that whole conversation of that Mulder is having with his tape recorder, which is now essentially now we know is a conversation with Scully.
Yeah.
And it goes on to a whole other emotional level at that point where he's talking about, you know, I don't have anything anymore. Before I could only trust myself. Now I can only trust you. I mean, oh my God.
And
they've taken you away from me.
That's almost like, you know what I love about that line? And even just the way it's written, it's very childlike. Like I like when Mulder kind of, you know what I mean? Like they've taken you away from me. Like it's like kind of not petulant. That's not the right word, but like, I like when Mulder kind of has these really vulnerable moments where it just sounds, it's just the way, something about that line, I don't know, maybe I'm not articulating myself very well, but it's just something about that line that I really like. It's sweet and it's almost innocent.
It is kind of like you say, there's a vulnerability there that we rarely see. And the fact that we know he's saying it to Scully is, at that point we've established that it's just so sweet. And I mean, we get a lot of insight into sort of Mulder's mindset at that point when he's talking about, you know, he's even beginning to doubt what is the truth and all that kind of thing. And it's all And there's the talk about evidence, which is kind of a subject that comes up several times throughout this episode. The concept of, you know, having evidence, not having evidence. And he mentions that again. You know, he mentions back in the conversation in the parking garage about, you know, after all my work, I have no evidence. And he says to Scully, I learned that from you, which Scully seems quite tickled about, frankly, at the time. And yes, as am I. And so he's very focused on this idea. He's become quite Scully-like in many ways in this episode, as he's kind of begun to doubt things and become kind of a skeptic. He talks a lot about finding evidence and not finding evidence. And it's the kind of thing that we don't normally hear him being too concerned about.
Right.
But it's something that concerns him at this stage in this episode where, you know, I can't believe once again I have no evidence. It's like, what does he say? Nothing but evidence of nothing or something like that. It's an interesting theme throughout the episode, this idea of, you know, what does he have? And at this point, he doesn't think he even has Scully. And he feels like, you know, without her, he has nothing. And it's like super sweet. Yeah. And you can kind of see where he is at this really low ebb.
Right. And I think that the idea, too, that he can't. It's I feel like we see this throughout the series. He can't say this to her. Like, he can't say this to her. He's saying it to a tape recorder. That's what we're going to get for now, is because he's saying this to a tape recorder. And she might never get it. You know, she's never going to hear this, obviously.
Yeah.
So it's just another example of them being able to confide their, even, you know, I'm not saying romantic feelings, but just their emotions in terms of how much they need each other. They can't say that to each other. It's very rare. Yeah. Like, I feel
like...
And
it's amazing we hear it at all.
Yeah.
The fact that we even hear him saying it to a tape recorder is fantastic at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, and I feel like, again, like, we don't... He's saying to her, you know, how much he needs her, but she's not hearing it. So
yeah,
we don't actually get that moment until what, Fight the Future? Like, it is several years down the road until he can finally actually say it to her face. So it's just a nice little evolution, and I do like the idea that he can't say it to her, so he's saying it to a tape recorder.
Yeah, sweet.
And I did want to bring up too that the fact that he is he's already considering that it could be a hoax, which is probably something that the old Mulder would never have done. And this reminds me too of like in Gethsemane later, when he's actually like becoming disillusioned, like to the point of like depression again, like when he's told, hey, it's all a hoax, everything's fake. And here it's almost like he's coming to that conclusion himself. It's like he's kind of sliding back, like we were talking about earlier. It's just kind of an interesting development for his character. But it is, like you said, when we get to the end of this episode, it does feel like he literally is holding her hand, and it's like he's got his faith back, you know what I mean? He's getting it back, and it's just it's a really nice little moment. We're not at the ending yet, sorry, I didn't mean to jump ahead, but
yeah. But even in Puerto Rico, as soon as Scully shows up, there's like that contact between them. He puts his hands on her shoulders, like he's almost like grounding himself when she's there. And, you know, she is his touchstone. Even then, you can see it.
That is like an underrated hot moment, by the way.
It is a very hot moment. And then Scully finds an excuse to touch his head at that moment, too. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's all happening. There's like a lot of unnecessary touching happening in that scene. There's a lot of unnecessary touching happening throughout this episode.
It's very true. And we will talk about some of that at a later point. But I think that there's this moment where he's looking through all the papers, and you know that Jillian just wants to grab his bicep, because there's no reason for her to be doing that. She's just like kneeling down and she's kind of grabbing his arm, and like you can see her hand like going, oh, well, look at that. It's very funny. And I love every single time. I'm like, God, she's so lucky, man.
Yeah. I mean, the biceps are looking fine in that t-shirt for sure.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. And I love anytime I can see like this whole, all the unnecessary touching, like there's no reason for it, but it's happening, and it's happening right in front of our face.
It's happening.
And I am enjoying it.
It's not going without notice, I'll tell you that.
Exactly. We see it all. but it's very nice. And I do like the fact too, like he's trying desperately to get his proof. He wants to get his evidence for Scully. It's like, but Scully, I've got evidence. Yeah. And they can't quite get it, of course.
Of course. They can't quite manage it.
They get away just in time. And I kind of always forget about this sort of exciting car chase out of the jungle.
This is a wild chase. This is like the only like significant action in this episode. As far as mythology episodes go, this is a pretty sort of character-driven, quiet kind of episode. Mm-hmm. And this is the only real action, I think, is this. The truck chase through the jungle is pretty great.
It is. And I like, there's a point where like, he's like actually trying to like hold her head down.
Yes, it's so, so sweet.
She's not going to get shot. I was like, oh, that's so gentlemanly. Yeah. He doesn't want you to get shot.
Protector Mulder is just so sweet. I just love it.
I do love it. I just love him driving that truck with his sleeveless great sweaty t-shirt.
It's
I enjoy
a hot
it
situation all the way around, and it's yeah, it's just it's a really well shot scene, and it's the director for this episode is David Nutter, and I think he did an amazing job.
Yeah,
because yeah, it's a very exciting scene. There's people are shooting at them, they're driving. It's like this is how you can do a car chase, vehicle chase in an exciting way. Mm-hmm. Sometimes vehicle chases on the X-Files not done in an exciting way in later seasons. But this one was cool, and it did not go on forever.
It's true. We have seen plenty of bad car chases on this show.
Yes, we have.
And they're all quite recent.
Yes, they are. But this one is a good one. You get a sense of the, it makes sense with the story. It's moving the story forward.
It's like gritty and real. It doesn't feel choreographed. It doesn't feel slick.
Exactly.
It just feels like they're really trying to get the heck out of Dodge. Like
This is not a product placement for that truck.
No, not
this
at all.
No one is there. There are no pretty looking vehicles in this chase. This is the real deal. And I love it. I love that bit.
It's a great little scene.
It's great.
So we have, before we get to the end, we have this final scene in Skinner's office where he's getting reprimanded by Skinner, and it kind of turns around though. I like it. I like how Skinner.
I love it.
Yeah, he finds, it seems like the tides turn when Mulder reveals his apartment has been bugged. That's the moment where Skinner looks over at Smoking Man like, wait, what? You didn't tell me that was happening.
There's just that little look.
Yeah. And it seems like maybe Skinner at this point, I don't know, this could just be my little conspiracy theory, not conspiracy, my little theory that maybe Skinner doesn't know at this point how important Mulder specifically is to the syndicate, to Smoking Man. And knowing that they're actually wiretapping his apartment makes Skinner maybe have a little bit of empathy or concern for his agent.
Right.
Why are you so interested in my guy? Like that's kind of the read that I got from that. Like obviously Skinner doesn't know this. None of us know all the history. We don't know why Smoking Man's obsessed with Mulder. We don't know any of that yet. But like, it seems like this is the first time Skinner's really getting that. And that's kind of what turns his attitude.
Yeah, I totally agree. And yeah, you can just see it in Mitch Pileggi's performance that the whole wiretap thing is like, okay, I did not sign up for this.
Right.
And yeah, you can just, he's like stealing himself for the rest of that scene. And it's just such a great payoff. I mean, you see CSM, again, we have this idea of what does Mulder have? And CSM specifically says to him, to Mulder, you leave with nothing, and except he's wrong this time, because that's the moment when Skinner says to who we don't know at that moment, get out. And as the viewer, I thought he was talking to Mulder, and Mulder thinks he's talking to Mulder. CSM thinks he's talking to Mulder, and it's only when Skinner says again, I said, get the hell out, that like, the look on CSM's face is so precious at that moment. I carry it with me every day of my life because he is, as they say in the UK, he is gobsmacked. He can't believe this is happening.
But he can't really do anything about it. He's in a position where he cannot assert his power in front of Mulder. So his hands are tied. It's such a cool, interesting power balance. Every time we have these three in a scene together, I love it.
It so is. And I mean, I can imagine maybe in later seasons, but I can imagine certainly Mulder was tempted to kind of go cock-a-doodle-doo to hell with you.
Yeah.
But Mulder's keeping it cool and not even really looking at what's going on. Like, okay, I'm not a part of this, but yay.
I think even Mulder is still kind of confused. Like, I don't think he quite knows what the hell is going on, but I think he's just kind of relieved he's not getting fired, probably, at this point.
Yeah.
He obviously is on to the Smoky Man. He knows he's around. Even Scully has seen him. They're probably, I wonder if they've even discussed him. I don't know. Maybe they have. They have to. If they're, like, discussing work stuff, they have to have discussed this weird guy who's always in Skinner's office and he's smoking, but we don't know who he is.
Yeah. I wonder what they think about him. What's their theory? They must have one. That's another fanfic. We've come up with so many great fanfic prompts in this.
We really have, but but it is worth repeating it. Skinner standing up to Smoky Man and telling him to get the hell out. It gives me a lady boner.
Oh, me too. Yeah. Totally. I love it. Like, Skinner is never so sexy as he is when he's telling Cigarette Smoky Man off. Yeah. It's the hotness.
I enjoyed that.
I mean, if you don't love Little Green Men for the many other reasons we've given, love it just for that one moment, because it's totally worth it.
Yeah, man, dude, this episode has just kind of soared up my list. Like, honestly, I really, really enjoyed it. But let's talk about this last scene, because I know this is one of your favorites.
Yeah, love the last scene.
You go. You talk about it.
Oh, okay. So Mulder's back on the job and doing his surveillance. And for some reason, Scully just has managed to sort of crash his surveillance shed. I'm not quite sure where Mulder is. It's somewhere that apparently you can spit sunflower seeds on the floor.
Yeah.
But it looks like kind of a shed or something. And they're reviewing what happened. And Scully, my favorite part is when Scully says, again, there's this subject, this theme of Scully saying, and Scully says it to Mulder in this case, you have nothing. Because they'd listened to the tape that Mulder thought would record the encounter he had, and it's blank. And so, you know, Scully's sort of feeling sympathy for him and saying, you still have nothing. And Mulder's response is, I may not have the X-Files, but I still have my work. And then he kind of turns away and he's fiddling with the tape machine, and he says, and I've still got you. And both Scully and I had the same reaction at that moment, which was, gawaw, okay. Yeah. And then he says, and I still have myself. So that's the whole, to me, that's the whole sort of arc of Mulder within this episode is, you know, for so much of the episode, he feels like he has nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And even when he's in Puerto Rico, he doesn't feel like, you know, he's saying Scully's been taken away from him. But by the end, he's figured it out. He still has Scully. They can't take her away from him because, you know, whether she's part of the X-Files or his partner or not, she is always going to be there for him. He's finally realized that by the end of this episode. And I mean, that moment when, you know, he's not looking Scully in the eye and he says, and I've still got you, is still like one of my favorite Shipper moments, because it is precious and beautiful.
And again, he can't say it to her face.
He can't say it to her face.
He's so shy and his back is turned. And it's, again, it's such a nice little progression, because we don't get he can't quite say it to her.
I love it. I love it.
Yeah, it's so nice.
Sweet. And Scully, and the way that Jillian plays that reaction too, because I think up until that second maybe she's sort of looking down slightly, but when he says that, she like looks right up like, oh boy.
Yeah.
It means something to her. It means the same thing to her that it does to me, which is kind of like, wow, that's saying a lot. That is saying a lot at this stage in their relationship.
And it's cool too, because it makes me think of like later down the road, like you said, no matter what, Scully's going to find a way in, he's going to allow her in, and they're going to keep doing their work. They're going to keep fighting and looking for the truth and doing all this stuff. Down the road when, Krycek becomes involved, there's a moment when he says to Smoking Man, Scully's a problem, a bigger problem than we anticipated, or something to that effect. And I mean, it's clear that they have obviously positioned her. They obviously positioned her to be where she is in the hopes that she would do the opposite of what she does. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's so funny to me to see that how, in spite of everything that they had hoped would happen, their bond is strong enough that like when they're split up, it actually emboldens them, and it makes them even more, you know, emboldened. I just said that, but
yeah,
you know what I mean?
No, and I think that their connection is stronger for having been separated, because they can't just rely on the fact that, oh, well, we're partners, so the relationship defines itself. When they're not partners anymore, they have to define the relationship in a new way, and they have to kind of articulate it. And which they would never have had to do otherwise. And they have to redefine it. And So that it does kind of strengthen their bond, I think. And, you know, it's always, you know, Mulder and Scully against the world. And the fact that they're separated and the X-Files have been shut down just reinforces that sense of they're out to get both of us. And we have to stay together, stick together. We have to work together to overcome these forces that are against us. Right. And that's very much the vibe in this episode and well, throughout the whole X-Files, really, but especially in this episode. And I always enjoy that vibe.
Well, Jen, do you have anything else you wanted to add about Little Green Men before we go into our hot take section?
I'm going to give a short shout out to the other my other favorite bits of unnecessary touching, where at the end of the scene in the parking garage, as Scully is leaving, she kind of pats like Mulder on the head. She touches his head. She strokes his hair lovingly. Yes. That's beautiful. And at the end of this final scene, she gives Mulder's hand a little squeeze. And that's very sweet and affectionate, and gives him a secret smile as she's leaving. And that's very sweet. And so I love those bits. Those were the kinds of things that we cherished with all our hearts back in the day when that's all we got. And there's quite a bit of it in this episode. And it's very precious to me to this day.
Yeah, that's good. That's definitely worthy of a shout out. All right, Jen, are you ready to do our hot take?
Okay, yes, I'm ready to our hot take.
Lay it on me.
Okay, hot take. Okay, Annie, hot take. Mm-hmm. What did Mulder do when he got home, listened to his voicemail, or I guess answering machine in 90s terminology, heard that message from the mystery lunch woman? Did he attempt to contact her again? What was his reaction?
I think he didn't. I think he
just let it go.
I think he wrote it off. I think he just gave up.
I guess, was it because of the you're a pig bit? Or because he was just done with her at that point?
I just think he's like, this is going to be a lot of effort. Like, women are a lot of effort, right? Like, I think in his mind, he's like, man, I'm going to have to do a lot of work to make up for this. And I just don't have the time. I honestly think that was probably what ran in through his head. And so he gave up. That's my
I would totally buy that, actually. I think you're absolutely right. I'd be curious, though. I'd kind of like your theory that he didn't really have her that much and didn't really care that much about having lunch. I just wonder if he listened to it and went, what the fuck is she even talking about?
Wait, like, I had a lunch date?
Oh, did what? You? Yeah. But I imagine when she called him a pig, he just kind of nodded and said, yeah, well, shrugged his shoulders.
Yeah.
Guilty as charged, probably. It's nothing, just probably nothing he hasn't heard before. So that's my hot take. What's yours?
All right, my hot take. So in this episode, we hear Mulder tell Jorge not to touch the red button. In fact, he says no ho on the rojo. So my hot take for you, Jen, is Mulder red green colorblind.
Oh shit. Yeah, he specifically says that the button's red. So he's not. The reality is, it's one of those things on the X-Files. Yes, it's explicitly stated in one episode that he's red, green, colorblind. There's no reason within that episode to think otherwise. But there's so much evidence in every other episode that he's not red, green, colorblind. So, no, he isn't. And there's no canonical way for me to explain why he is suddenly red, green, colorblind in one episode and not the rest of the time. But he's not.
Well,
that's my theory.
I tend to agree with you. We had a big conversation about this on Twitter the other day, which is why I'm bringing it up. But the only reason that because you know me, I always try and find it a canonical explanation. I think that, and I am not red, green, colorblind. I don't know anyone who is red, green, colorblind. But I don't necessarily think that just because they see red differently, they wouldn't still refer to it as red.
Okay, maybe he knows it's red even if he doesn't see it as red.
Right. Whatever he sees as red or has seen as red his entire life, everyone else calls red. So that's what he calls red.
Okay.
So, and I would love if somebody who was colorblind or red, green, colorblind, if that's your experience, would weigh in on this, because I'm very curious about that. The only really good bit, and to me that solves it. The only really good bit of evidence that people have said is that if he were red, green, colorblind, could he actually be a field agent? And I don't even know the answer to that. Is that actually something that he couldn't pass a test with because of the red, green color? I mean, being blind is different than being red, green, colorblind. So I don't, I feel like it almost seems discriminatory to say you can't be an FBI agent.
I guess. Yeah, I don't know. It depends on how strict their rules are, I suppose. I mean, like, there are certainly some jobs you couldn't do, like you couldn't be a pilot or something like that.
Yeah.
So I don't know. That's a good question. The red, green, colorblind is one of the biggest continuity problems on the X-Files, in my opinion, because we only have one piece of evidence that he is red, green, colorblind, and we have lots of evidence he isn't.
Remember the lost art of forehead sweat thing?
Yes, that's true.
We have that. So we do have two pieces of evidence, and they come from Mulder himself. So he could he could be.
It's
just
hard. Yeah. It's really hard because I can't deny the evidence that's there. Like you say, in Lost Art of Forehead Sweat, there's an implication that Mulder can't tell whether the goop ABC is the red or the green kind.
Yeah.
And which I love the idea of that being one tiny bit of continuity back to the red, green, colorblind thing.
You know.
And I don't know how to explain it because there's just so many times where he doesn't appear to be that, and only one or two times when he does, and it's problematic.
This is definitely one of those things that I'm like, I'm not dying on any hills. I don't really care. It's not that big of a deal. And the more I thought about the red, green, colorblind bit in Lost Art of Forehead Sweat, the more I thought that was the writer's way of poking fun at that particular thing,
because
because of the way that they deliver those lines. Like, he says, well, you know, it could be the lemon lime, and then she goes, well, oh, like, it's like she kind of laughs like, oh, that. And it made me think that, like, they, it's something maybe they've chatted about, or they're obviously, she's aware of it, but she forgets, because you would forget.
Right.
It's not something you talk about. It's not like, hey,
I guess not.
Guess what? Which colors I'm seeing the world in today, Scully? Like, it's not a conversation that comes up. But it was just a funny little moment in the revival. And it does make me laugh that they're kind of acknowledging the idea.
I feel like that was, I feel like that was Darren Morgan kind of having a little bit of a joke there about, like, you know, I'm going to just, it's almost like I'm going to sort of have a little laugh. At the same time, I'm going to show off slightly. Like, look at me. Look at the continuity I can bring to the table. And it's like, good for him. The question I had, though, like, Mulder seems to know, like, no Spanish. Like, you mentioned that you sort of know enough Spanish to sort of pick up the basics of what Jorge is saying. Now, I'm Canadian, and we learn French, so I know some French, but I know zero Spanish. Does it seem odd to you that Mulder seems to know zero Spanish almost in this episode? Would a typical American know more Spanish than this?
I don't necessarily think he doesn't know any Spanish.
No, he seems really baffled in his conversation with Jorge. He can't even seem to say the most basic thing.
He's picking up certain words, and Rojo is red, so it's not he's not making a cute. He is making a cute rhyme, but he's not just making up a cute rhyme. Like, that is red in Spanish. So I mean. He knows.
I feel like he knows, like, some random words, but he doesn't seem to know anything about the syntax. Like, he's saying "noho" on the "rojo." Like, he's got this combination going on.
Let's cut him some slack. He's in a very intense situation. He's not focused on his syntax. Like, come on.
But there's no, like, actual sentences. Like, when he's asking his name, that's like one of the first things you learn in most languages, learning how to ask someone what their name is. And the best he can come up with, I think, is nombre, nombre. It's like, really? I'm pretty sure that's not how you ask specifically someone's name. Just yelling name at them.
Well, I got
to
tell you,
very limited to me.
From the high school Spanish that I remember, I can't tell you right now exactly how to properly ask someone is it te llamo? Like, I would probably be like coming up with something that's wrong, and in the moment when I'm panicked and all this crazy stuff's coming out, I would just focus on the words that I know. Like, so I don't know.
Fair enough.
And Mulder is like, he doesn't strike me as the kind of guy who is like brushed up on his Spanish. So I mean, I think he's doing the best he can, Jen.
I'm being very hard on him.
You are. I'm not going to give him slack. If he were in a situation where he were going to interview a witness or something, I would expect him to be more prepared. But I don't in this situation. Like, I feel like maybe he had like his like Spanish phrase book on the plane, and he was learning some. Maybe he never took Spanish in his life, and this is the extent of his Spanish. Is the what it's he possible. Read in a phrase book on the plane, literally on the way to Puerto Rico. So let's cut the man some slack.
Yeah, I mean, this was before the days of Google Translate, right? So if he had Google Translate, if this had happened in the revival, he'd be all set. You know, we don't really have to worry too much about phrase books anymore. Google Translate will do that for us.
It is amazing how interesting they were able to make the revival X-Files, considering how many things that they don't need to figure out anymore.
Yeah, right? I mean, things were just much harder in the 90s.
How are any horror/mystery shows even viable anymore? Like,
no,
I just
you can solve everything with Google one way or the other.
You literally can.
Just do a search, do translate, make a Google Doc. I don't know.
How do I do this? I have my phone. It's done.
Yeah. Like, whatever it is that you need to do, your phone can do it now. Yeah, but it also helps to move plots along in ways that were never possible in the 90s or the early 90s, because you can just have a nice, easy cell phone call to sort of convey information that you wouldn't have been able to convey otherwise. So it does definitely move plots along in a much more efficient way than we could have at one time. So it's a lot harder to deliver information without cell phones.
I swear to God, I wonder all the time what my kids must think of my phone, because I do everything on it. Like, what's the weather going to be like? I need to buy some tickets. I need to check.
Yeah.
And I'm always on it and doing something. And I'm like, they must think, what is that magic box that mommy's always on? And how does it know everything? And I can't even fathom having anything like that as a kid. Like, they do actually, you know, we're getting off topic here, but they do actually, because of that, think that we can somehow get whatever we want. Because we can now. Because we can now. Like, we need toilet paper. Click, click. Okay, I ordered it. Like, and it'll arrive tomorrow. Anyway, that was quite a tangent. But it's interesting how things have changed since the 90s, is my point.
I mean, it's a great time to be alive, in my opinion. I mean, I'm glad to be alive and to be part of the generation that went with no cell phones to regular cell phones to smartphones. And to have computers in there as well, just to see the birth of computers, because my life is so different than it was when I was a teenager. And it's thanks to computers and smartphones. And those that were born later or are being born now will always take that for granted. But to me, smartphones are a miracle, and I will never take them for granted.
Yeah, I agree. It has escalated rather quickly in the past couple decades.
It really, really has. It's amazing. And I mean, cell phones were always a big part of the X-Files, but they were just cell phones back then. But I still thought they were really cool because I didn't have a cell phone back then. And so I thought Mulder and Scully were super cool with their cell phones. And when I got a cell phone for the first time, I got a Nokia, because that's what Mulder and Scully had.
Well, that makes sense. Product placement worked.
Yep, did.
Well, let's wrap this one up, Jen. Thanks, you guys, for listening. If you have any comments about Little Green Men or the mythology, I mean, we haven't really talked too much about the arc, but we're going to get into that more when we start talking about Duane Barry and what's going on with Scully. This is sort of more, like you said, character driven. So, but let us know what your thoughts are at XFD Podcast on Twitter. And we will be back with you in a couple weeks on another episode of X-Files Diaries.
Bye.